It is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us, of course, on a Friday morning. We rebroadcast him during the weekend, also following our 12 noon news. David is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. He's got his own website, of course, themediabeat.us, and he joins us here today. Happy day after Thanksgiving, David.
Happy day after Thanksgiving to you, too. I'm in the media capital of the world, as usual, of course, and in normal times, if you can remember times that were normal, this would have been also the annual magnet for the rest of the country, the rest of the world in some ways. Television broadcasts go globally each year, or have gone globally each year, with the Macy's Thanksgiving Parade. And it did happen yesterday, but it was certainly nothing like the Thanksgiving Day Parade we've all been used to. And it was curious because not only was there no public, spectators were discouraged. You even had it turned instead into a largely pre-taped, edited television show. So there are pieces in it, many pieces in it, which were pre-recorded on other days. And what is revealed, I mean, how that sort of very basic piece of television magic, if you like, or conventional trickery was exposed was the fact that on Thanksgiving Day itself, much of the shortened route of the march, it was pouring with rain. And yet, of course, and all the pre-recorded segments that came in between, they were fine and sunny days because they were recorded over the last week. So it had a very curious, unreal feel to it, which I think was kind of emblematic for our age now.
A perfect Thanksgiving for 2020. Yeah, they. I read the reports. 90% of what is normally in that parade was not in that parade. The 10% were some live entertainment and stuff like that. And only, I think, four balloons made it to this for this parade. So
yeah. Yeah, well, we live with change, right? We have to adapt to our current times. And I'm glad just before we came on air that you played to the audience the press conference, if that's what it was. It was the first time that the president, since his defeat in this election, has actually taken questions from the media. And it was an interesting exchange, as always, though not for the sort of reasons that you normally find a press conference with the chief executive of our government, simply because he excelled himself, if that's possible, in ridiculousness. The snippet you played was so revealing. He got so tired of being put on the spot by one particular reporter. He got nasty with him, to use a favorite Trump word, and described the reporter as a lightweight, and contrasting that allegedly lightweight reporter with himself. I am the President of the United States. He says, you don't talk to the President of the United States like that. Never talk to the President like that. Yes, well, what can we say? This is the outgoing president. I suppose that's what you put as the final summation of an event like that. And by the way, some actual information, quotable information, came out of it too. He did acknowledge that if the Electoral College vote goes against him, which of course it will, though he doesn't think it, I mean, he pretends to think it won't necessarily go against him, he will just naturally move out. He said, I will do that. I will do that, and you know that I will. We haven't known that he will, and of course it doesn't mean just because you said it that he actually will, but It is a quotable sentence. I will move out, was the message, because Biden will have been declared president, and it's the first time we've had that. It's not exactly a concession, but it's something close to an acceptance of reality.
I guess what disturbed me wasn't, you know, he wanted to dress down a reporter. He can dress down a reporter. It's not right, but he can. I mean,
oh no, it's what he said about himself. It's a disturbing thing.
Yeah, can you imagine him saying that to someone like Sam Donaldson? I don't think so. And Sam Donaldson was on the White House beat. I just don't think that would have come out of his mouth. But the thing that he said that's really upsetting is that if the Electoral College votes Joe Biden in, it will be a mistake. And once again, whether you like the Electoral College or not, it's part of the way America holds elections. And to say that it will be a mistake just will keep the, out of the 70 million that supported him, there's probably a good 50 million that believe him, that he still should be president. And that's the dangerous thing that he keeps doing all the time, not realizing what he is setting up for future elections.
Well, not caring what he's setting up for future elections. I think there is a process at work here which is not exactly worked out, not exactly sort of strategized to a fine degree, but it must obviously be in his mind that this is a way that confidence on the part of the American people in their own voting system should be degraded. And if you can get a populace that is which has lost confidence in the voting system, then you've got an entity which is extraordinarily malleable to the kind of autocratic leadership that he claims to, well, that he believes he it's important for him to operate, because I think it's because he doesn't know any other way to operate. He always ran his company as a one-man show, and in which his word always went, and there were no checks and balances there, of course, and the checks and balances in the traditional governmental sense that we use them, are simply anathema to his form of desiring to be in total control, and weakening Americans' confidence in the elections is an absolutely perfect way of ensuring territory is ripe for that kind of leadership. He's made no secrets of the fact that he would like to do it again in 2024. And he'll be that much older, of course. It'll be an even stranger picture than before if he were to try. But I don't put it past him. Nobody should put anything past this particular president. The fraud notion that the election was a fraud, that's why he said the Electoral College would be making a mistake. And it wasn't he was neatly enough not accusing the Electoral College of anything, but he was saying that they would be making a mistake based on voting, which was fraudulent. And of course, he has no evidence for such fraudulence. The cases that he's been pursuing, or his team has been pursuing, have collapsed or been withdrawn at every turn as the legal challenges have been attempted. So there is a strategy, a clumsy and rather obvious strategy, but it's clearly there, and this is the overall effect that he's after. And of course, with a good many people, as you say, possibly 50 million, he may be successful.
You know, he called Joe Biden Sleepy Joe during the campaign. Well, you know what? I think this country needs a Sleepy Joe right now. Just, you know, I mean,
well, something is not jagged and edgy constantly hyperactive like a child with a tantrum. In a sense, that to that degree, it will be a great relief.
The other story that we look at, of course, is this coronavirus and how it has just exploded. The Midwest now is the real central location. And if you look back in time, Most experts now believe that a quarter of a million people that showed up for the motorcycle rally that happens every year in Sturgis is probably the main
in the Dakotas.
It's probably the main indicator of why it has spread so badly in the middle part of this country.
Yeah, I mean, there are super spreader events of various sizes. That was one of the bigger ones. There are others, of course, in communities where, for instance, as in the case which got to the Supreme Court on the very late on the eve of Thanksgiving, revealing that. The case went the way of churches and synagogues being freed to have as large gatherings as they wanted and not be stymied by a governmental, in this case the New York State governor's ruling, that they should be limited. And this was regarded by the a 5-4 majority, at least, in the Supreme Court bench, as a violation of the religious freedom under the First Amendment, but the argument, of course, is the practical argument is that large gatherings, people in close proximity, often vocalizing their ritual as required can run the risk of being a super spreader event, and in many communities that seems to be what has been happening. The extraordinarily spiking in so much of the country can be laid at the door of various different communities. So the community of people on Second Avenue in my neighborhood, by the way, could qualify too. People who sit at the bars, they're restaurants, but they're effectively being used at bars all down Second Avenue. It's a terrifying thing to have to walk through if you have to go that way. And I always cross to the other side and I have to zigzag down the avenue in order to avoid the clusters of people who are very visibly doing all the things that we're urged not to do. Sit close to each other, shout loudly into each other's ears, because of course music is blasting at these places out in the open air, and obviously not wearing masks because they're drinking and eating. Many of them smoking too, which is an odd picture. But yes, the capacity for super spreading is, it seems, a constitutional right, and it's being exerted negatively by so many people who believe that gatherings are okay right now. It's very clear. The numbers are very clear about this. If you don't take the precautions, your region, your district, your neighborhood will turn into a spike, a coronavirus numbers spike.
And the people have to get used to this. The 5-4 vote included. Roberts and
Chief Justice Roberts. So it's an interesting tilt that we now have a majority of conservatives, but the Chief Justice feels it is his responsibility to be something of a evener, and to some degree, I guess it's not the first time, of course, and we've seen it before. But now, I guess he'll be tugged in that direction more and more because of the Trumpian effect of a majority of conservative justices now.
Elections have consequences. All right, with that being said, do we get the bugle out this morning?
Let's play the bugle.
All right, hang on one second here. Let's bring the bugler up to the microphone.
The fanfare goes to a journalist who's been looking at the phenomenon of super spreading, but it's not the virus, although it's clearly got parallels with it and a distinct relevance to it. The writer is Shira Frankel. She's a journalist has been a journalist for many outlets, including NPR and nowadays the New York Times. And much of the time she was building her reputation, she was doing it in the Middle East, a day-to-day reporter in that very tricky region to report, as you know. But now she covers cybersecurity for the New York Times, and she's done a remarkable piece this week, which basically tells how super spreaders of rumors and misinformation carry out their work online. And it's a remarkable piece for being so detailed. The numbers are vital to it. I'm not going to quote them now because it's something of a an ocean of numbers, and you can easily get lost. And thank God for the printed word, I think, and that you can go back over a paragraph and get things clear again. Not that it's dense and hard to understand. It's not. It's just that if you want to get the numbers straight, you may have to take it slowly with the occasional repeat. But it clearly shows how the spread of the election fraud story, the alleged election fraud story, has been engineered, and it's been engineered very carefully. And the key to it, of course, is a cluster of individuals with high followings, right-wing commentators, most of them. Essentially, you can. I'll quote one figure which shows it. There are over the reactions of the New York Times, spearheaded by Shira Frankel as the lead reporter, and they collaborated in this with various research organizations. Actually several of the groups are associated with Stanford University, and we know how Stanford, as the university of the alma mater, if you like, of Silicon Valley, it really knows its internet, and the Elections Integrity Partnership and the global human rights group Avaaz have gone along with those university units and the New York Times in conducting this investigation. And the kind of number that is so striking is that the interactions online that they have followed and narrowed down to in order to chase them to their source. The retweets, if you like, the likes, the commenting on, and the citing in new postings of the original postings, is clearly seen to be the work of a small group of what Hillary Clinton used to call politically motivated people. And so this figure that I'm struck by so much is that it was just 33 of a sample 95,546 posts, but they were responsible for 13 million of these interactions, you know, the furthering of the rumor, the spreading of it by, as I say, retweeting and all these other ways that people can encourage pieces of misinformation to grow and to spread. So tracking it down, I mean, it's interesting. The interested parties, the responsible parties, turn out to be no surprise. Eric Trump figures amongst them, second son. Is one of them, and there are various others who don't need any more encouragement. So I won't go through the list, but you know them. I mean, if you spend any time on the web at all, you'll recognize these people. But the really valuable thing journalistically about the piece is that it shows how you don't need a massive information drive to spread misinformation. All you need is a well-tuned network, and that's clearly what the Trumpians have in the face, in the shape of these particular 33 well-followed individuals. It's a fine piece of journalism, and I commend it.
You know, one thing social media has done has tarnished the role of journalism. And I don't mean to true journalists, the journalists that when they write their bylines, yes, their bylines are their bylines, their stories are their stories. But when true journalists cover news events and talk about news events, they keep just to the facts. Well, social media now has turned that into, you now have you have journalists, and then you have social media journalists where alternate facts are real facts.
Well, yes, one of the disturbing things for me, looking at the way that newsrooms operate now and how that operating style has changed, is that you of course as a newsroom look to certain indicators to show you what issues and what happenings are important. You'll look to, you know, the agenda of leading politicians, who see what they're doing, where they're going, what are the main topics of their speeches. That's one way of keeping your finger on the nation's political pulse. And of course, television journalists will keep a very close eye on what print journalists are putting out, because print journalists have traditionally always been the originators of new pieces of what we do call news, for obvious reasons. And amongst the and the other thing, of course, is official announcements. I mean, the world of the press release is a world that journalists have always needed to follow, well, since they first existed, have needed to follow the flow of press releases that come out of institutions, whether governmental or commercial or any other kind. And that's, you know, that's all very understandable. Now, however, elevated to the same level of influence, it seems to me, in many cases, newsrooms are just looking at Twitter and seeing, you know, what are the trending topics in Twitter and other social media outlets. And that, of course, is one of those self-fulfilling prophecies. Yep. That we're always warned about when it comes to taking an objective view of what's happening in the world. If you think that the Twitterverse is some kind of indicator of how the world thinks, you're on very, very shaky ground, of course, and yet newsrooms seem to be behaving a lot of the time as if what is said on Twitter is somehow an expression of public opinion. That's a hard entity to define, ever, I know. But it's so easy and lazy, of course, for journalists to just fall back on social media as some kind of significant guide to what it is they should be covering. And that, of course, has been magnified extraordinarily by the Twitter-in-chief. We have a president of the United States who spends a phenomenal amount of time using his thumbs to think out loud. And that, of course, is a presidential utterance. And in the last 4 years, slowly at first, and then, you know, unquestionably, just a torrent that was unstoppable. Mainstream journalists have accepted it and use it now as the equivalent of getting a quote from the president. It's not. It's a quote from the president's inner recesses, and has its value, of course, but it's not to be confused with, you know, whether it is the president or anybody else behind a particular tweet. It's not to be mistaken for what we would, you know, can genuinely call real news.
Well, and here's the reason why. When you look back at journalists over the years, when journalists, I think newsrooms tend to now because, like you said, they're lazy and they're not staffed as well as they used to be. They use the Twitter universe or social media as a way to get a lead on a story. But unfortunately, that lead on the story ends when they take that story and then just repost it and reuse it. It used to be when a journalist got a lead, they would do all the footwork that needed to be required to verify that lead, not only speaking to one person, but many people to verify that lead, and then they would come out with that story. That's no longer the case with most people, and I'll say most, I won't say all, but probably 90% of the people that post these thoughts and these stories on Twitter and even on Facebook, there is no work that goes in to verify anything.
Sure, I'm with you all the way there, and I don't want to sound as if when I say laziness that I'm condemning the entire profession of laziness. So, I mean, one important contextual fact that we have to regard here as very influential in this mix is indeed the financial cutbacks that newsrooms across the country have suffered, and the fact that journalists don't have the time to do that shoe leather expending follow-up work that you say is so, and you say quite rightly, is so valuable, essential, in fact, for utterances from anyone to be processed into something that deserves to be called news. It has to be worked on by the journalist. It has to be checked out. It has to be compared with other people's views. It has to be put in context of the time and of previous events may have led to it. All that is work, and perhaps in many newsrooms there just aren't the people to do that kind of work anymore, and it's regrettable. And it's of course when fed, as it has fed into this superheated partisan world fueled by social media, then of course you end up with the situation being made many times worse.
David, once again, happy Thanksgiving to you and the weekend to you, and we will speak to you next week.
We look forward to that.
Take care. David Terechuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. Once again, you can find him on his own website, themediabeat.us.